Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about agroforestry, or, hey, is that tree there Roundup ready? So that's why you were giggling about that. Anyway, we're joined today by our friend Chad Cully. And Chad, why don't you introduce yourself rather than me doing it improperly?
Okay, I'm Chad Cully. I currently work for the Cincinnati Zoo, and I live in Northern Kentucky.
Okay, so you work for the zoo, but what do you call yourself, like a botanist?
Call myself a horticulturalist.
Okay.
And a nursery person.
A nursery
person? I work primarily in the nurseries at the zoo.
And you call yourself a kind human being, right?
Sometimes.
All right, well, the topic that we're touching on here, and we sort of, or at least I linked in on the term agroforestry. Could you tell me what that means, what that's about?
Sure, yeah. Agroforestry, it's a bit like saying agroecology. And in fact, maybe the theoretical basis for agroforestry is in agroecology. And agroecology is like kind of just taking all things into consideration. So that could be the interaction between plants and animals and humans and the environment with agriculture. You might also then say that agroforestry is just kind of like it's the same thing, but then also saying, well, we're gonna focus on adding trees and shrubs into our crop and pasture land.
So is this
it's a holistic approach.
And is this a new thing, or is this going back to what we should have been doing all along?
It's probably really an old thing. It's probably something that we've been doing for a long time and that we've just kind of lost track of somehow.
I was going to say, because it doesn't seem like we're doing it at all now. There are pockets of people or individuals that are doing this and frantically trying to make a difference, but it doesn't seem like that is, we're still mostly focused on a monoculture of growing singular things and killing everything that influences that.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like everything else, you know, it's just a new buzzword now.
Well, it's important that we label things.
Yeah. Well, humans need that. We need to have names for things, you know. That's how we remember what they are.
Well, so. I can envision, you know, like a cornfield or a soybean field. We see this all the time. What would a true agroforestry environment look like? If I were looking at something that would meet the textbook definition, how would that look to me?
I think the textbook definition is going to be completely different for every neighborhood, every bioregion, every climate. It could be a little bit different everywhere. Really, the gist of it is that, you know, you're gonna take a look at all the systems on your farm or on your land. It could even be in a small piece of property, and it's basically just, you know, if you've got animals, you're going to incorporate some big trees and some shrubs into that system somewhere. Maybe the animals are going to use the trees as shade. And then you're going to, somewhere in there, you're going to use some of that space for cropland as well. And again, you're going to have trees mixed in with that. But then you also could look at more of the bigger picture stuff too, and say, you know, you're looking at the economy of your farm, or maybe you're looking at, where is the water going on my farm? Where is the soil going on my farm? What's the history of my farm? You know, what's the culture of my area? What's the recreational use maybe? You really can start to get into the weeds and start to look at many, many different things. But I don't think there's any one way to look at these types of systems.
That's the whole thing, though, isn't it? You know, that's the exact opposite of monoculture. You're just basically saying, let's consider everything that impacts this area, not just this place where my feet are standing, but what what is all of that that's there? What are the resources we could use? What are the things that are challenges? All of it. Insects, people, everything.
Right. It's almost like saying, hey, my land is a public space in a way, because my land affects what's going on out in the world. And so, you know, it's just sort of taking a more responsible approach to land use and to the things that exist in the commons.
Well, that goes very much against the good old American ideal of manifest destiny and this is mine. You know, I saw that a lot when we lived in Europe, where it felt to me anyway, and maybe I was idealizing it, that people took an attitude of, look, I am the trustee of this property for the moment, and I need to make sure that, you know, I pass it along to the next generation or to my society, you know, in as good a shape or in better shape as when I was given control over it.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely a byproduct of our system. But I don't think it means that we have to give up private ownership of things. It's just, you know, space is getting tighter, right? There's more people, you know, maybe there are less resources too. And so maybe we need to consider how we use space and land a little more closely.
Well, you had mentioned the thing about that your property, your agricultural field, your forest, whatever it is part of the whole, is part of a public space. And that brings up the whole idea of the commons. You know, that was a thing in early pioneer days, of a commonly held property that everybody could, you know, graze their sheep on or whatever. Is this something that fits into this model where there are commonly held resources in the agricultural model?
I mean, I there should be.
There should be. That's right.
But, you know, this is not a new idea either. I mean, if you look back to, you know, the medieval times, you know, even when the king might have had, you know, a large piece of property, but, you know, there were certain pieces of lands that were set aside, and, you know, basically if you're farming, you could use some of that space for growing food. I think historically these types of lands were often held in common, and, you know, as far as like recreation or hunting or farming, that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it's not a new idea. It's just maybe something we've lost track of.
But we have examples, but Chad, we have examples of that. We have national parkland. We've had lots of presidents who saw the value of that and nationalized forests. And I mean, we're falling apart from that now. They're giving these things away and allowing fracking and destruction of forestry and forest land. But we have a history of that. It's not the same as having a common green in the middle of the town where all the sheep came and grazed. But we do have, Americans seem to care about parks. They care about having green space in their community, but we're not putting enough emphasis on it, I think.
Right, yeah. And I mean, what's happened to that, though? I mean, it seems to be maybe working backwards, you know, presently. I don't
Well, everything has to be monetized, you know. And if we don't want to monetize these things, but we monetize stuff like how much it costs for gas and things like that, but then we're not monetizing what the value of those trees are or that green space. We just say, oh, there it is.
So sure, it's an investment. Those trees, those forests and those trees are an investment. I mean, you know, if you think, you know, what does America have? It's a bit different from maybe from Europe, and it's definitely the national parks. I mean, those spaces are pretty unique, and we have a lot of that kind of commonly used land, and you can, I mean, in modern times, you know, it's you know, you look at the Bundys out in Oregon, and they're kind of, you know, they're trying to open up that conversation, because if they want to, you know, they want to graze their cattle on the land that, you know, it's federal land, and they say, well, hey, this is, you know, we're the best people to take care of this property because we know it the best. We're the closest to it. We, you know, we're using it all the time. And, you know, why should the federal government come in and tell us what to do with this property?
Well, mainly so, because, you know, that property doesn't belong to them.
Well,
that
I think
would
that's
be the argument.
But that's the point. Yeah. But who does it belong to?
It belongs to the citizens of this country.
Yeah, and what they're saying is we're one of those people.
Yeah, one. That's
exactly
the key.
Right.
Well,
so how is that different if I go into the forest and I go collect seeds from the forest? Did the federal government or did democracy, you know, did our democracy give me permission to go collect those seeds?
No, you'll get arrested for that, but you can run your cattle in there.
Yeah.
Sure.
Or you can frack it, or you can destroy
it. Okay, well, I think we know where Annie's coming from on this, but I think what you're opening up there, Chad, is that there is a conversation that needs to be had because, you know, there is a public-private partnership that could work and could be sustainable. You know, and maybe that's something we need to begin exploring.
Absolutely. If you look at cities like Atlanta, they have a community forest in Atlanta now. I believe it's 6 acres. And so maybe, you know, maybe we need to talk about community forests because those community forests, they could potentially provide some food security, some food justice for underserved communities. So why don't we talk about that?
Well,
why don't we reimagine the commons?
Yeah, but even more so, I guess other things is that if we were to look at those green areas or reforesting those areas, we would invite life back into those communities. The unique birds that maybe lived there 100 years ago who have had no habitat would return, and they're demonstrating that a lot in England with some fairly large tracts of land where they've created something called silvo pasture. And so they have these meadows and grassland areas, like a prairie kind of thing, but it's very small, in among the forests. And all these birds and plants that people haven't seen in 100 years or more have come back to those spaces. So we could invigorate. Thank you.
I'll be your thesaurus for today.
All right. Invigorate an area just by changing how we look at it. But we also have modern versions of these things, like when you look at community gardens, where people come together and there's a space set aside. That's a modern version of the commons in some ways, because people can grow food and flowers and all kinds of things that help the community too through pollinators having food and such.
And so the other side of the story, though, is, you know, if I own 20 acres and I want to farm it, I don't really care what your vote is, and I don't care if the birds or the deer want to vote about what to do with my property. I just want to make some money. I need to feed my family, right? So maybe, you know, if you're talking about agroforestry, then agroforestry might say, well, what about doing some alley cropping? So you might plant maybe a row of chestnut trees, and then, you know, maybe 20 feet over, you plant a row of elderberry, and then 20 feet over from that, you plant a row of currants, and then you do maybe, you know, 40 feet of lettuce or kale or, I don't know, potatoes, corn, soy, whatever you want to do, and then you repeat with trees, and you're just farming in between trees. So that type of, you know, row cropping could potentially, you know, give some biodiversity, but then, you know, maybe publicly, or as far as the public is concerned, they're a little bit happier with that, because whatever's running off of your farm in terms of water or soil, it's not getting into the, you know, into the public's water source.
Okay. Well, know. I'm gonna interrupt you here for a second, Chad, and remind everybody that you're listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God. And so we're speaking with Chad Culley from the Cincinnati Zoo, the horticulturist and all-around good guy, talking about essentially rethinking. I think the rethinking goes a lot further than maybe what we've touched on. So we're rethinking monoculture, which is a big task. So, Chad, you've got your work set out for you to deal with the Monsantos of the world and the like.
We all do.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Thanks, Chad. You're
but
right.
But I think it. What struck me when you were speaking is that really it's a matter of rethinking the relationship of land ownership. You know, I think that's something that as a culture, as a society, we had a group of Swedish students who were talking about the rights of man. And I think Sweden's a good example where their concept of land ownership is very, very different than ours. You know, the concept is you never really truly own the land. You have the rights to it, but other people do too, as long as they don't interfere with your right. So like I have the right to walk across your land, but I don't have the right to damage it, things of that nature. So I don't quite know where that all fits in there, but I think that's something that we need to evolve into, where land ownership is not cut and dry. You know, there's not, I'm going to fence it, and on this side, I get to do whatever I want. And on that side, I have no say. You have no say on my side of the fence. Is that making any sense to you, Chad?
I think that's exactly the point. I mean, if I have 300 acres of corn and I'm dumping X, you know, number of pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus onto that property every so many months, you know, what does that do to the water supply? So that's a public concern, you know. That's causing algae blooms. It's, you know, do the fish get a vote? Do the birds, do the bees, do they get a vote? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a discussion we need to have. But also, I think in that discussion, you know, I think farmers need to be included in that discussion. They need to, you know, they need to have our support too. So we can't just say, oh, well, it's the farm's fault, because it's our fault too. I mean, what are we going to talk about? All the buildings that we've built in the cities, well, what does that do to biodiversity? So I don't know. I mean, we're all to blame. It's not just farms.
It sounds like we have to just kind of grow up and be adults and actually discuss
things.
Well,
admit that the reality of our behavior is destroying everything.
Well, there's that old line that your right to flail your arms around stops when it hits my nose. You know, it's like, yeah, if you want to stand over there and swing your arms around, that's fine. Just don't punch me in the face, you know.
That's a really terrible analogy.
But I like it.
Okay, that's good. That's all that matters.
A good analogy is worth something. No, yeah. But basically, these guys have the right to grow their food and to make a living. And we don't
make a living. They're not making a living. Right, this is okay. the stupid part of it.
But that's that's self-delusion. And you can say that the situation is not ideal, which clearly it is not. But we can't say there are good guys and there are bad guys in this equation. We just have to say, let's all just try and look at the whole.
Well, here's the problem. Human beings have this amazing quality that they will just keep doing something until they have destroyed everything and look up and go, what? How could that have happened? How could all the trees be gone? How could all the birds be gone? And so I think our responsibility through this podcast and through everything else we do is to talk about what is possible. So what can we do to change things? What can we do to create more biodiversity and agroforests and more common thinking? And because
okay, so Chad, you've thought deeply about this. How are we going to solve? How are we going to fix the world?
I don't have all the answers.
Okay, just give me one.
I just want to put that out there.
That's all I want. I just want one.
Before you answer, I want to give you something you told me, Chad. You said if we want people to change, if we want things to change, first of all, we have to make the solution cheap or free. We have to have the need for not much skill to make it happen, and we also have to have the need for it not to require a lot of luck. You told me that. Do you remember telling me?
Why did I say that? What was I thinking?
Gosh, Chad, you used to be so wise.
But that's what you said. If we want people to change, it's got to be cheap or free, require little luck, and almost no skill.
Well, I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I'm glad I said it, though.
But, I think it's profound. I like it.
So, I don't have all the answers. I just, there's a nice little example of something like this with New York City that I think we could look at. And the city of New York basically had this problem where they wanted to deliver nice, clean water to everybody in New York City. And they wanted to get their water from the Catskills and from Delaware County, New York. And so they said to these rural areas, this is what you need to do with your property so that our water is clean downstream from you. And of course, the people in those areas were not pleased because they were imposing all kinds of restrictions and regulations on people that didn't deserve to be restricted and regulated in different ways from the people in the city. So, so that the city could get their water. Well, ultimately, the gist of this is that New York City had to just pay these rural communities. And you know, they did so voluntarily, but, you know, it's primarily because they were getting paid. You know, they're making some kind of income from essentially not polluting the water in various different ways. And that could be from, you know, industry, or it could be from farms or whatever the case, or even keeping your property in forest is helpful too. And that's what this kind of agroforestry thing is all about, in my opinion, is often just about creating biodiversity and tending to the water and the soil and the air too. So, I mean, I think the lesson from that sort of New York case study is that, you know, they kind of, you know, they gave the farmers more or less what they wanted, or they at least attempted to meet them in the middle. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road is, you know, there's got to be a compromise. You know, politics is the art of compromise. So we can't just regulate and impose restrictions on people that are desperately trying to survive. So
They did that in California with the auto industry, though.
All right. But I think the issue is, you know, if you've identified a problem, why not ask the guys who are involved in all aspects of it? In fact, even those that are causing the perceived problem, you know, hey, how about if we all come up with a solution together, which is what I'm reading out of what you were just talking about, rather than coming in and saying, the problem is we need clean water, you've got clean water, you're messing up the water, so we're going to impose something from the outside, is really just walk into the group and say, hey, here's the goal. We all want clean water. How do we accomplish this? Because the farmers aren't, I mean, their whole goal is not to pollute the water. That's a byproduct.
So who's going to be the leader of this? This is the challenge, because when you go to...
Well, I vote Chad.
Okay,
I mean,
all right.
Chad, you're now the leader.
He looks like a university.
No, we're all the leaders.
No, it's not true. It is true. We're all the leaders of our own behavior. But here's the problem. So it's true that there's a need for a lot of coming together, but this has not been historically how we've dealt with things. You know, we live in a country that's all about the individual, in the media anyway. And so there's got to be some balance here where the government, and I brought up the whole thing with the car industry where California went against emissions and said you can't have certain emissions, you got to have control. And there was a lot of hell that was raised about that. Oh, excuse my French. And what happened was it drove the whole industry worldwide and it changed everything.
Right. Well, that's what's one success story, but I think where we're coming from, our response has usually been through regulations and the like that are imposed upon people rather than coming up with a solution that everybody can live with.
But we need to have somebody who has the power to pull the people who are the deciders, because it's not going to just come out of Joe Smith, who's down the road and he farms 1,000 acres.
Maybe it can. Maybe it can.
I don't see it.
I don't know. I'm reading into this discussion that maybe there's a different way. You know, you're talking about what's the art of the possible. Having somebody impose a rule upon you tends to just create more rule breakers, you know. But if we all come to this solution together and it meets all of our needs, that's the ideal. So how do we do this, you know, economically, politically, socially? And just plain sitting down and talking to each other sounds like a better approach than passing a law, which we see.
But rewarding people for doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But people have to have that happen somewhere, mm-hmm. or they won't do the right thing. It's against our human behavior.
I know. I think those rewards come in a lot of different ways. I don't believe that farmers or timber or miners or any of these people who rely upon heavily industrialized activities set out each day to try and destroy the world. You know, so they're tied into methods that are probably not the best methods that we could come up with if we all tried to work together and come up with a solution.
Okay, they may not, but they also don't really care at the end of the day.
Oh my gosh, Chad, back me up on this, man.
I'm with you, Jay. Yeah, I mean, I think 80% of people live in the cities now, something like that, and then it's just getting, you know, bigger. The cities are getting bigger, fewer people living in rural areas. I live in the city. It's really dirty here. We're polluting here in the city. I can tell you that. It's a mess here. I mean, there's garbage everywhere. How far can you drive through any parking lot in the city without seeing some kind of oily spot in the middle of the parking lot? You know, I mean, I think it's crazy to say that farmers are the only ones making a mess. That's just
okay.
That's
I'm not saying it. I'm not saying that. Right. I'm just saying they don't want to hear.
No, I know you're not saying that, but I think that oftentimes people are pointing the finger at farmers and saying, "Oh, well, I want this certain quality of food," and blah blah blah, and you know, this is what you're doing is dirty and it's polluting the water. And well, you know, if we want that kind of stuff, we got to pay for it.
Okay. Well, I think
we got to work somehow. There's got to be a compromise.
In the words of the immortal philosopher Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us, right? So, all right. Well, you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our guest today, Chad. Thank you very much, Chad Culley from the Cincinnati Zoo.
Yeah, thanks.
And we want to thank our Emmy Award-winning producer, Adam Ridge. And we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and grow some food, Jay.
Grow some food sustainably. Okay, until next time.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.